Raising the Bets is brought to you by the StarQuest Production Network and is made possible by our many generous patrons. If you'd like to support the podcast, please visit sqpn.com/give. You're listening to Raising the Bets. We're a Catholic couple raising five kids outside of Boston. Join us as we share the joys and challenges of marriage, homeschool, and our adventures near and far as we make sense of the world and experience the best parts of our culture. I'm Don Bettinelli.
And I'm Melanie Bettinelli.
It's hot, Melanie.
Yep.
Yes, it's summer. It's hot. It's always hot this week in summer. It's unusually hot for us this summer. We've had a wonderful summer. I've mentioned that before, where the weather has been gorgeous. It's been not so nice for other people, but we finally got the heat wave. Let's get it over with. Moving on. Back to our regularly scheduled summer.
Yeah. I mean, it's hot.
Yes. The Texan says.
Isabella, Sophia, and I spent several hours outside on Saturday. At the flea market.
Yep.
And it was warm. I was very glad that there was that we had a canopy so that we were not sitting in the sun. But, you know,
yep.
I still haven't lost my ability to deal with the heat, I guess. I was pleased to know. I was glad I wasn't having to bustle around or stand in the sun or walk long distances or work very
right.
hard. But
yes, know. God bless everyone has to be out in the heat. So before we get talking about what we've been up to, I wanted to read some listener feedback on our last show and get our response for that. This came in on our Discord community at sqpn.com/Discord. Anyone can join. And Mama Jean sent in this feedback. She said, I always enjoy listening to your weekly conversations. I listened last night and was inspired to respond to Melanie's critique of the new Netflix Persuasion. I rather enjoyed the show, but mostly because of the acting. It only resembled Austin's novel, but probably would have dismayed Jane as it missed her point of writing it entirely. I see what you're saying. All right. I'm trying to read that in the right tone. I would suggest you go to Ellie Dashwood's YouTube discussion of this adaptation of Persuasion. She does an excellent job of explaining it all. So
if you're going to call what you're doing an adaptation and not be
in missing the point entirely
and missing the point entirely, then why adapt?
Yeah.
Why adapt it at all?
Well, this is the thing is like there are movies based on books, say, that aren't anything like the book, but are enjoyable in and of themselves if you divorce it entirely from the book, right? If it's not the book and you know it's not the book, like even just some of the modern adaptations of some of the Austin stuff,
I prefer if you're going to sort of be loosely based on, give it a different name.
Yes.
And make it clear that you're not attempting a faithful adaptation.
It's an homage.
Right. Like our friend, Kat Hodge wrote a adaptation of Mansfield Park, and it was set in Louisiana in the 20th century, but she gave her characters different names and it was its own work of art. It wasn't claiming to be Mansfield Park. And I think what bothered me about this was not the direction that the story went, but that it was not at all Persuasion.
That it wasn't the story. It took the name and the appearance of the story, but didn't actually do the story. The characters were different.
Well, it sort of like put a different person calling them the same name and give them the sort of basic plot points, but the spirit was completely different. Mm. The character was not the same character. She's just got the same name and is going through the same story outline.
Right.
But it's like putting a different person into the story. It's just kind of it was almost too close to the mark and too far away at the same time.
Like an Uncanny Valley sort of thing.
Right. Like, you know, Clueless, which is an adaptation of Emma, takes place in, you know, a modern adaptation, which isn't really trying to capture Austin, but uses the plot. That's different from something which tries to have it both ways, I guess.
I mean, there are Shakespeare versions of that, right? Like, there are modern movies that are like a Romeo and Juliet story or a Macbeth story without being, without like using the names and trying to tell you that this is an adaptation of Romeo and Juliet, but, you know, Romeo is.
Well, and then, but then there are also things that try to call themselves Shakespeare, you know, Shakespeare's Romeo and Juliet, that drop so many of the plot points that they kind of are no longer really Romeo and Juliet.
Right.
And I have a problem with that. Like the Leonardo DiCaprio Romeo and Juliet, it lost some enough basic plot points that while it's sort of an inspired by, it really isn't the play that Shakespeare wrote anymore.
It would be like trying to like changing West Side Story and changing it to Romeo and Juliet and, you know, naming, you know what I mean? It's like, but like doing the same play, but just changing the setting back to Verona. What is it? Verona? Where's
Verona?
Is it Verona?
Verona where we lay our
skin. Okay. That's right. Okay. So back to Verona, name them the Capulets and the Montagues instead of the Sharks and Jets, but keep all of the songs and stuff in, you know, and Tony is, you know, New Yorker.
You put the West Side Story script, but call it Romeo and Juliet and keep all the names the same. Then you hit an uncanny valley because you're calling it Romeo and Juliet, but the dialogue and the story are West Side Story. Like, West Side Story clearly is a Romeo and Juliet homage. And yet, the problem, who Tony is and who Maria is, are not this, they're not the same people as Romeo and Juliet. And the lines aren't the same. And the setting isn't the same. It's when you get too close while at the same time too far away that you get the weird, uncanny.
And then you have like all of the Tony and his friends all with the New York accents and, you know, swaggering around and using 1950s slang while wearing, you know, Renaissance clothes in Verona. And that's kind of, I think, the complaint against Persuasion is it's the anachronisms. It's you're neither fish nor fowl. You're either set in Regency England or you're set in the 21st century. But, don't do both.
Right. But at the same time, I mean, clearly there is an audience for it or they wouldn't have made it. I mean, clearly.
And clearly Mama Jean enjoyed it.
Right.
Which is like, there's nothing wrong with enjoying things.
Right,
you can enjoy things.
Right. Like, there's nothing wrong with enjoying something that I don't enjoy. I mean, there's nothing like absolutist about my, it's just, this is sort of, I draw the line at being able to appreciate something when it gets too far away. But yeah. I'm glad that you did enjoy it because, you know, I'm glad that there's an audience because I do feel like a little bit bad for the actors and directors who obviously worked really hard on this adaptation, that it must be really hard to pour your heart's blood into a project and then have it universally panned.
Oh man, it's going to be, I mean, cash the check, but yeah.
I mean, I do have to say that there has been a little, you know, voice in my head that says, man, to have like really thought that you nailed this role and you to really have loved what you, the work that you did, and then to have it be so little appreciated has got to hurt.
If they indeed loved it and thought they nailed it, which sometimes they don't. I actually wanted to make one point about people enjoying things, because there's this thing on the internet where people aren't allowed to enjoy things or to not enjoy things. Like if I dislike a thing, there are people out there who insist that nobody enjoy it. Like if you say you like it, there's something wrong with you. You're a jerk. You're an idiot. Or, you know, and we have these flame wars. I've seen it over Star Wars and Star Trek and Marvel and all these other fandoms and Lord of the Rings. You know, hey, I'm looking forward to the Lord of the Rings TV series on Amazon.
And I am not.
Right. And, you know, if I watch it and I enjoy it, then I'm going to enjoy it. Like there's no reason to get down on people for enjoying things that you don't, or vice versa. I liked the first Hobbit movie, you know, so
I hated it.
Yes, you did. But it's okay to to like a thing, and it's just let people like things. That's really what it is. So if, you know, I haven't seen this Persuasion, so it's not a big
deal. You don't really like Jane Austen.
I'm not a Jane Austen fan, but you know, if you dislike Persuasion and you say that you dislike it, that's fine. If Mama Jean or others like this, that's fine. I'm glad actually that you like it and you can enjoy it, that you found something you enjoyed and had fun. It doesn't have to be the best thing ever, but as long as you enjoyed it, and that's what's important. I think that's a big lesson to take from this, is let people enjoy things. Anyway, Mama Jean, thank you for your feedback and for letting us have this conversation about enjoying things. So let's talk a little bit about what we've been up to lately. We had a nice opportunity the other night, which we have rarely had, which is to go out as a couple and do things with other couples, to have a night out with other couples. My brother and his wife invited us over to their house, sit around their fire pit with some other friends that we know and just hang out. And we haven't, I don't think we've ever done that since we've had kids.
To hang out with other couples.
Just to hang out on a random night, not anything like super planned, but just to, because we've never had babysitters.
Right.
Like when your mom or your dad or your sister come up, they will watch the kids while we go out to dinner or something like that, because that's our opportunity to get out. But I don't know. Some of you out there are able to find babysitters. Power to you. That's awesome. We've never been able to find sitters for our kids, like regular someone to come and sit with them, five kids.
Partly because I'm not comfortable with leaving kids with people I barely know.
Right.
Like people do it.
No, I'm with you on it. So now Bella's 16. That's plenty old enough. And Sophie's 14. So it's time we can actually go out. It's this new phase in life. I'm kind of almost giddy, like, what can we go now? Go out and do things. So I know we talked about actually going, you and I going out to the new Thor movie to see that, because
that would be fun.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, so anyway, it was a nice night. We went over to my brother's house, and he has this really nice fire pit and area, although I think there's sand fleas or something, because you and I got bit pretty good on our legs.
Yeah, my legs are all over bug bites.
Yeah, but it was nice to see. I mean, we see Chuck and Eileen all the time over at John and Patty's, but we saw my friend George and his wife, Susan, who George and I used to work together at the Archdiocese in Boston. And so I don't get to see him as much as I used to. Obviously, I used to see him every day, but it was nice to catch up. And who else was there?
That's it.
That was it. Just the four couples. Right. Okay. So I thought there was, I kept trying to think, was there someone sitting next to you? It was Patty.
It was Elijah.
Yes. We left space for Elijah. So that was nice. And then, actually I went back today with the kids to their pool to take them swimming, while you stayed here. And
either that, or it was the, which was the polar expedition where they kept imagining that there was a third person.
I don't remember that.
Oh,
there was a polar expedition and they thought there was a third person with them.
They kept hallucinating that there was another person there.
Or maybe not. I'll have to ask Jimmy Akin about that.
It's in the footnotes for T.S. Eliot's Wasteland.
Oh, wow.
But I do not remember which expedition it was.
Okay. So another thing that you and the girls were working the flea market again for Troop 13. Right. So, and you had said that it was a nice opportunity to.
One thing about hanging out with the girls in Scouts in a public forum like that is how many people come up to them and then want to talk about scouting because they're there with their uniforms, especially older people.
Yes.
The girls were very patient with some of the older people who wanted to talk about scouting with them. There was one old gentleman this time who said that he had actually corresponded with Lady Baden-Powell.
Right.
Lord Baden-Powell was
the founder
of scouting. And his wife had sent a letter to this when this gentleman, when he was a young man, and he had actually met her in person. So the girls were suitably impressed. Like, now there's like 2 degrees of separation between them and Lord Baden.
Or 3 degrees.
Yeah. Between them and Lord Baden Powell. Like, they've met somebody who met his wife. That's kind of cool.
That's kind of, I mean, that's going back over 100 years, you know, that's right? Of time span. So that's pretty wild.
So that's, it's always fun. The flea market is one that they have every Saturday at
the church that charters the troop.
Yeah. Church. And it's an interesting place. Like, flea markets are always really interesting places. And it's kind of nice to just sit around and get to know some of the people at the church that sponsors them. Cause it's not our church.
Right.
And so the guy, getting to know the guy who runs the flea market, Dave, and some of the other people who are obviously regulars there. One lady asked the girls about scouting. She sounded a little defensive, like, my daughter's in Girl Scouts and my granddaughters are now in Girl Scouts. And why would you want to join
Boy Scouts
instead of Girl Scouts? What's wrong with Girl Scouts?
Everything. No.
but she she asked the question and she listened to our answer and she thanked us at the end. Like, thank you so much for telling me. I understand better now. And I really appreciate that.
And you
taking the time to tell me about it.
And you told her.
We kind of talked about how not all Girl Scout troops are as, like, outdoorsy and engaged with doing all the outdoorsy things. We also talked about our family's personal experience with Boy Scouts, which was that the girls used to hang out with their brother's Cub Scout troop and do a lot of the activities with them. And so when the opportunity came for them to continue to hang out, but actually earn the merit badges for the stuff that they were doing anyway, they really jumped at that. Like, it was more of a matter of, we were already kind of a part of the Boy Scout community, and this was just giving them an opportunity to earn the badges along with the boys, mm-hmm. as well as doing the activities along with them.
My take is that the Boy Scouts, BSA, is more institutionally oriented toward the outdoors. Now, an individual Girl Scout troop can be more outdoorsy, but it's much more dependent on local leadership, the quality of the troop, than for BSA. It's much more institutionally, you know, down the line.
I do find, though, that if you tell people who are very invested in Girl Scouts that they're less outdoorsy than the Boy Scouts,
they get defensive.
They get very defensive. So I always want to kind of say, just in our experience, not every troop is the same. I also feel like the Girl Scouts get very, very invested in the whole
cookie sale
thing. And
that was one big thing that you and I were both agreed on, that we didn't want to get any entangled in at all.
Yeah, just not really.
Just from our own personality and our family dynamic, we just do not want to get in. It's hard enough to get them to do the flea market.
And I know some boys, BSA troops, do a lot of more of the, like, selling popcorn and stuff like that. Our troop has opted for fundraisers that don't involve the kids trying to sell things.
Well,
as much.
Why in the world? Like, the Girl Scouts at least have hit on something that people want. Nobody wants this popcorn. Like, this microwave popcorn is, like, I'm sorry, but it's the worst thing to sell. Nobody, microwave popcorn is marginal at best and to begin with. And so the only reason people are buying this stuff from the kids is because they feel sorry for them or want to support them. Nobody wants the Boy Scout microwave popcorn.
On the other hand, the grandma's coffee cakes that our troop sells,
yeah,
those are really, really good.
There's a local bakery called Grandma's Coffee Cakes based in Boston.
I think it's actually called My Grandma's Coffee.
My Grandma's, yeah. And they're in all, like, the local grocery stores, or not all of them, but they're in a lot of the local grocery stores and stuff. And they have a fundraising thing where things like scout troops can get the cakes at cost and sell them. So that we take orders and then people pay up in advance, and then there's a pickup day where everyone can come and get them. And we every time they do that, we buy a handful and shove them in the freezer eat them over the next 6 to 8 months.
These coffee cakes, I swear, it's the best coffee cake I've ever,
yeah,
ever had.
But this is
like, it's like the crack of coffee cakes. Right.
But it's an easy sell. It's not like going out and I have to sell boxes and boxes and boxes of candy and go door to door and stand outside of stores. This is, hey, anybody in the family want to buy some grandma's coffee cakes from the Scouts? Ooh, yeah. And then, like, what do you want? I'll take this 1, 2, and 3. Okay, just Venmo me the money, and then you're done. Like, it's a nice, easy, low-pressure sales environment where, I mean, I've heard the horror stories. I mean, and again, depends on your Girl Scout troop, so don't email me. Yes, it depends on your Girl Scout troop, but I've heard the horror stories about the cookie sales wars. And we stay far away from it. But I have history with Boy Scouts. You know, I was a Boy Scout myself, and then the boys are in Boy Scouts. And it's frankly much simpler to have all of our 5 kids in BSA within a couple of organizations in which the leadership is all pretty much the same and connected, and it's all the same families.
Right. The families in the girls' troop are by and large the same families in the boys' troop, and they coordinate a lot of things so that you're not trying to be pulled in 2 different directions by 2 different organizations.
Yeah.
That's a huge part of it.
It is. It is.
For our family.
So, another thing I wanted to talk about was we talked last time about the classes, the Homeschool Connections classes that Bella and Sophie are taking. We've also started getting Anthony involved in some of those. I thought we'd mention a few of them.
I thought we did mention them, but
it's possible. My notes only say Bella and Sophie, but folks, I'm sorry. My memory is terrible. So if this is a repeat, you can just skip ahead. But so Anthony's is taking classes on the parasites class that Sophie took.
Right.
Science, technology, and medicine in the Middle Ages.
Which is really cool. He's been telling me about the various classes from the science and tech of the Middle Ages, and he's very excited about it.
Mm.
It's a nice way to get some more history and from kind of his the perspective of something he's really excited about, which is science and tech.
Right. And then the other one is coding using Minecraft is the class. So learning how to program and the concepts of programming using Minecraft, the game, as the basis. And he's never played Minecraft before, but it's essentially Legos on a computer. I mean, there are differences, obviously, but it's essentially it's a building block sort of game. And he started looking at the course information, and he's like, I need to know more about the game before I can take the class. So we've been letting him play Minecraft as a way of getting familiar with it. And so he's been really, as I knew he would, like all 11-year-old boys will, loving Minecraft. I hear some, I can imagine some of you parents out there laughing at what we're about to get ourselves into with this, with Minecraft. There is a Minecraft obsession that boys can get into. We're not going to let him watch YouTube videos. That's one thing I've heard people say is the endless talking about YouTubers who play Minecraft. It just drives them batty. So we're not going to, he doesn't watch YouTube except for what I watch. Like the kids only watch videos that I'm watching, and I don't watch Minecraft videos. But he's interested and he's getting into it. And my hope is that this will introduce him to programming, computer programming, and he'll get into this more because I think he'd be really good at it.
And my hope is that he will be less bored and therefore less prone to
getting into squabbles,
the kinds of problems that children get into when they're bored.
Yes. Yes. Idle hands. So yeah, that's really a big thing is he keeps talking about how bored he is and needs something to do. So this is something to do that isn't playing games, you know, video games.
It's educational.
Yes. All right. So that's this week's learning segment, I guess. We don't really have segments, but I guess we do. But let's talk about food, because that's what I want to talk about. So earlier this week, we had ice cream for dessert. As one does in the summer. And you decided to go to gild the lily and make some hot fudge sauce.
Well, see, I have very fond memories from when I was a kid of hot fudge sauce. And I realized that our kids have never, ever had hot fudge sauce. So I've been actually pondering this for a long time, like meaning to do it. And I finally got around to doing it.
Okay.
And
so make your own hot fudge sauce.
Make your own hot fudge sauce. So this was the recipe I used, was used heavy cream, baker's chocolate, cocoa powder, butter, and vanilla, mm-hmm. as well as brown and white sugar. It was really lovely and fudgy.
Interesting.
Most of my cousins have very fond memories of my grandmother making hot fudge sauce. We lived further away, and I think I remember one time visiting grandma and having hot fudge sauce. So it was not quite as solid, but I did not use the recipe from my grandmother that my cousins had shared on Facebook because it used condensed milk and we didn't have any.
I've rectified that. I bought some at the store.
I'm going to have to, try a second batch when this batch is gone of fudge sauce with the condensed milk, and we're going to have to like see which one we like better.
Okay. I'm suddenly having a realization that we had ice cream for dessert tonight after dinner. Did you have hot fudge sauce on your ice cream?
I did not like the ice cream. I thought it was gross, and I didn't even have any ice cream.
Oh, okay.
It was really grainy.
It's this one particular brand. I was struggling to pick out a brand that the kids can never agree on what they want. I should have just got chocolate and been done with it. The Brigham's chocolate. Mm. I got the Brigham's coffee for me because I like coffee ice cream and nobody else does. But okay. Did the kids have fudge?
They did not have fudge because I was not going to break out the fudge. It was late. I wanted them to go to bed. I just gave them ice cream and they were happy and they didn't remember that there was any fudge left.
Okay. Well, the fudge is there for the next time when we get some better ice cream.
Hot fudge sauce goes with vanilla ice cream. It doesn't go with mint. Chocolate chip chocolate ice cream.
I think hot fudge sauce goes on any ice cream. I think it will go especially nicely on coffee. So you made some hot fudge sauce. Now, I revisited a couple of recipes that we've talked about recently. I made more buffalo wings again this time. And if you'll recall, last time it came, the method was really good. The wings, the deep frying the wings, they were crispy and nice like that. The sauce we felt was a little liquidy.
It was runny and it didn't stick to the wings well and it didn't really have a strong punch.
So this time I had leftover sauce from last time and I wanted to increase it. So rather than add more butter, I didn't add any extra additional fat. I added more hot sauce and Worcestershire and Tabasco to the sauce. And heated it up and mixed it up again and then let it cool a bit. That was the big thing. This is once the sauce cools a bit, it sticks to the wings better.
When it's too hot, it's too runny. It runs off.
Yeah. So I would say, basically
it was much better this time.
Yeah. I ended up basically having the butter. I added all the ingredients for a recipe, to double the recipe except the, I didn't add any butter. So I basically halved the butter amount and it was really good. It was like, this was get a spoon and eat the sauce good for me. I mean, this was some of the best wings I've had. Not Drover's wings, obviously quality, but up there. So really pleased with it.
It was really tasty. Yeah.
Yep. I also made soy sauce wings again for those who do not like, the spicy, I've seen a video referenced that I haven't watched yet about smoked and deep fried wings. So you do both?
You smoke them and then deep fry them?
Yeah, I'm not sure which goes first. You probably deep fry them first and then smoke them a bit. I don't know. I'm curious. I'm not necessarily going to do this, but smoked wings I've been seeing more and more stuff about. So I'm curious about it. Another recipe I revisited was I smoked another steak picanha, actually two, because it came in a package of two. Just as a refresher, a picanha is a cut of beef that is common in Brazilian cooking, Brazilian steakhouses. And the way they usually do it is they cut it into big strips and then fold it over into a U shape with this big fat big fat cap on the top. And then, and then skewer it through and cook it like a horseshoe sort of shape thing. I don't do it like that. I do it whole. I tried to trim more of the fat off before smoking this time. I could have even trimmed more, I think. I really could have. And then in the end, we were making steak fajitas with it. In the end, I had to just cut the whole fat cap off when I was slicing because there's a huge silver skin underneath. It just makes it inedible. So I just had to cut all that off. But I'm pleased to say that with the smoker, I'm getting better control of the temperature. You know, when I was first doing this, the temperature was like, you know, 220, 340, you know, all over the place. I was able to keep it pretty much, apart from a little hiccup at the beginning where the fire almost went out, I was able to keep it, you know, it was over the course of 3 hours, the last two thirds of the smoke, I was able to keep it right around 250 to 290, you know, in that range. 285, I think maybe it was the high. So really pleased with how I'm getting a hang of how to manage the temperature. And it's tricky with an offset smoker. I mean, I'll be honest, a pellet smoker, you set it, you tell it what temperature you want it to be, and it stays there. It does all the work for you. And someday, maybe I'll get one of those. But I want to know how to do it the hard way first.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, that's just...
I don't understand that.
Okay. Well, also, a good pellet smoker is like twice as expensive as the offset smoker.
Well, I do understand that.
Yeah. But there was a friend was saying, I think it was, I forget who it was saying, but was saying that it's listening to a podcast. That's what it was. Her husband bought a smoker, a pellet smoker grill, and it is so solid. Like it set the temperature and it stays there. She uses it as her summer outdoor oven. So she doesn't have to turn the oven on in the house. She just wraps whatever she wants to cook in an oven. She just wraps it tightly in foil and so it doesn't get all smoky and then cooks it in the smoker. I'm like, that is a great idea because these days I just don't want to turn the oven on when it's this hot. So let's talk about some stuff we've been watching and reading. Because I was outdoors smoking all afternoon, I didn't get to watch Loki episode 4 with you and the kids. And I don't have a strong memory of what happens in that particular episode.
There's a little bit of a deus ex machina, which I caught this time much more clearly. So, you know, episode 3 ends with Loki and Sylvie. I don't know why I say Sylvia. Loki and Sylvie stuck on the planet during the apocalypse. Like the ship that they were hoping to escape on broke, the temp pad broke, and they're stuck. And suddenly, out of nowhere, the TVA, they show up on the TVA's radar because there's a huge convergence. And so the TVA show up and arrest them. And I'm like, wait, does the convergence happen because of what they do after they're arrested? Like, is there a paradox here? Because right. I don't see why there should have been a convergence.
Well, the whole point of being in a place where that's going to be destroyed, you know, a civilization destruction event, is that nothing you do there should matter.
Right. So it felt like a paradox. Like the only reason there was a convergence was because the TVA showed up to pull them out of the apocalypse.
Right.
Which, like, hello, smoke and mirrors. Don't look too closely behind the curtain. I nodded off a couple of times, I have to say. It was Saturday afternoon and I was sleepy. So basically this episode has Loki and Sylvie finally confronting the Time Lords, Timekeepers, face to face and discovering that there is sort of a Wizard of Oz moment. There is nothing behind the curtain. They're just animatronic creatures.
Like, spoilers, but okay. I mean, that's fine. Yeah, we're a couple years out, so don't worry about it.
But it was kind of weird in that nobody was supposed to get in to see them. It was like getting in to see the Timekeepers was almost impossible. So then why go through the farce of having robots if nobody got to see them?
Right. And who was behind the robots? And
who's behind the robots? And what's her name? The lady who's
Ravona.
Ravona, who seems to be kind of in charge. She did not seem at all surprised by the fact that they were robots. So she knew?
She would have to know. Otherwise, yeah.
So I felt like, remembering what I do from the end, I don't feel like all of my questions were answered, but I'm going into the last two episodes of the series with like much clearer questions that I want an answer to.
Right. Yeah, actually, it'll be good to watch that ending again, because I remember being confused and not getting, knowing that there was something, a subtext that I wasn't understanding.
Right.
To the person that they confront and all that sort of stuff. I'm hoping some of these questions get answered in season two. There is a season two coming.
Ooh, there is a season two.
I think it was announced at Comic-Con this past week that there is a season two. So
that was not clear before now that there was going to be another season.
There's also going to be a Captain America with the new Captain America.
That will be fun. I'm looking forward to that.
And the trailer for Wakanda Forever. Have you seen that one yet?
I have not seen
it. Oh, you got to see that. It's really good. It's like, wow. So that, another Ant-Man, Guardians of the Galaxy 3. And then they announced that there's going to be two more Avengers movies before the end of Phase 6 in 2025.
Wow.
Yeah. 2025. That's
a long time away.
Yeah. I'm kind of wondering who the Avengers are. You know?
I guess we'll figure that out by then.
I mean, there's Thor.
Right.
And new Captain America, Spider-Man, I guess. Anyway, it's really interesting. So this one ends, this episode of Loki ends on a cliffhanger, sort of, and then they give you a post-credit scene, which is unusual for the series.
Right.
It was the only post-credit scene, if I recall correctly.
I think so.
Yeah. Where they get pruned. At the end.
Right. Because all along, you've sort of been assuming, as one does, that when somebody disappears in a big zap, that they're dead.
Yes, they're disintegrated.
They're disintegrated. Well, it turns out the pruning isn't actually disintegrating. They use the word advisedly because they're just sending you elsewhere.
Right.
Which was an interesting twist I did not expect.
It was a good twist. That was one of the best twists. And then the post-credit scene is, as you see, elsewhere.
Right.
So, yeah.
That was one of the moments that worked for me in the series.
Right.
Not everything worked for me, but that did.
So, something else that I watched was the Gray Man movie on Netflix, which is it's an adaptation of a book series.
You've talked about the books before.
Yes, I have, because I've talked about the ones I've read. And I'll be talking a lot more about this on the Secrets of Movies and TV Shows with Father Chip Hines and Thomas Sanjurjo in an upcoming episode. But just kind of briefly, like I said at the top about Persuasion, it is not a completely faithful adaptation of the books.
Right.
Okay. The character even of the Gray Man, the lead character, is not a lot. It's somewhat like the main character, but there are definite differences. That's fine. I enjoyed the movie for what it is. I definitely enjoyed it. There is a lot to like. Ryan Gosling is really good as the lead. Chris Evans as the bad guy is over the top. Like, so much playing against type, right? He's playing against the Captain America image, and just he chews the scenery. I mean, he is just great in this. Just so bad as a bad guy. There is a moment where, what is his name? He was in Sling Blade. Oh,
Billy Bob Thornton.
Billy Bob Thornton's in it. Okay.
Okay.
And they have this scene where, like, at the very beginning, it's not a spoiler or anything. It's the very first thing you see where he's de-aged. So they're like 2003, you know, and it's 18 years ago. And they have this de-aged, it is so distractingly weird. Like, it does not look normal. It looks weird.
Uncanny.
It's the uncanny valley is really there. And it was very distracting. But it's a great action movie. It moves action, you know, consistently.
Uh-huh.
Anna de Armas is in it. She's pretty good.
Who?
Anna de Armas. Did you see Knives Out?
Yes.
She was the maid. She was the young woman who was
the
subject, okay. You know, the not the part of the family young woman.
Right.
She's been in several other things. So, yeah, that was The Gray Man. You also watched a movie that I didn't see.
Right. I watched Everything Everywhere All at Once.
Did that take a long time? Because it sounds like that would take a long time.
Surprisingly, not that long. So This was a movie which came out pretty recently.
Yeah, it's just there this year.
It's just this year. And several of my friends have seen it, and it's gotten incredibly mixed reviews among my friends. But the premise really appealed to me. She's a mom of an adult kid, and the movie starts off basically with, like, it's about her trying to do her taxes.
Right.
Getting audited by the IRS. But then she gets called to save the multiverse.
Right. It stars Michelle Yeoh.
Michelle Yeoh is fabulous.
Yeah, I love her and everything. She's really good.
Really, the whole cast was fabulous. I really loved the cast. I liked the story a lot. The premise was really great, and the follow-through was really great. But I couldn't give the movie two thumbs up because there was really distracting bits that I found over the top.
There was an agenda at work.
Not so much an agenda as a lack of being disturbed by the kinds of things that disturb me. Like
it's kind of hard to say without spoiling everything, I guess.
Just sexual stuff that's like off on the margins, way on the margins, that I found visually really troublesome.
And gratuitous.
And somewhat gratuitous.
Yeah.
There was a point in the story, but I thought that you could have told a perfectly good story without that. It would not have been the same story, though, I will grant you. So, I don't know. I feel like I want to recommend it, but with a big caveat, because I think that a lot of our listeners would probably be disturbed by it and would not appreciate it or enjoy it. Among my friends, there were people who loved it, and there were people who absolutely hated it and thought it was a huge waste of time and very disturbed by it and did not at all appreciate it.
Yeah, I have a strong stomach for things, but based on the stuff you told me about, I don't know. I think I would be annoyed.
My reaction was that you would not like it.
Yeah.
However, the story really was a story about love and family and redemption. And I liked that. I liked that in the end, what saves the day, like she gets all of these amazing superpowers because she basically has the ability to channel any of herself in the multiverse and do the kinds of things that they can do.
Mm-hmm.
Which means she basically is like superhero. She can do mad knife skills and martial arts and gymnastics and anything she wants by tapping into her multiverse selves. But really, what saves the day is her ability to love the people that she sees and to see them for who they truly are and to love them despite their flaws or not even despite their flaws, just to love them. And really, it's very rare that you see in a movie ability to just love wins the day. Like real love, not sappy romantic love, but to see the really unpleasant tax lady and to be able to say, I love you and mean it, and to find the good and the beautiful in the people that she encounters. And it's really about family, her ability to finally see and cherish her husband and her daughter and her father, the people who she's been, they're too close to her and she's been taking them for granted and not even seeing them in the busyness of life. So the everything everywhere all at once is kind of both her distracted state at the beginning of the movie where she's trying to do everything. She's trying to be everywhere, but she's, because she's trying to be everywhere, she's not really anywhere.
So it's a metaphor for, yeah.
It's a metaphor. And I liked that. So if you don't mind things that are disturbing, the movie does have a really good message.
If you don't mind things that are disturbing, you might really enjoy this movie.
Right. I mean, on the whole, I did actually enjoy it. I just really wished I could edit out about less than 5 minutes of the movie.
Okay. So a couple of interesting things about this movie. The one of the actors, his name is, I'm going to butcher this, Ki Hai Kwan. He was the kid in Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom.
Really?
Was that the
husband?
It's this guy. I'm just looking here. Is that the husband?
Yes, I loved him. Yeah. He was awesome.
He was out of acting and just decided to get back into it again.
His character was great. He's the husband. She overlooks him because she thinks that he's weak and silly, and he puts googly eyes on everything. And it turns out that actually that's his superpower, is to be able to laugh, to take pleasure in the little things in life.
Mm.
I mean, again, another really great character moment. His character was awesome.
Yeah, so he was also in Goonies too. He was great. He was a great kid in Goonies.
With the
Inspector Gadget sort of kid.
Yes,
he opens the jacket and the spring loaded, comes out and punches.
Basically,
you.
This is what his character in this movie is.
Mm-hmm.
Is that character an adult?
Okay.
Like he basically plays the same sort of character, that wide eye, enthusiastic excitement. And it's fun because he gets to do these sort of different personas based on his multiverse persons. So right. He's like, at one minute he's the goofy, awkward guy, and then the next minute he's like suave and debonair, and then he's like martial arts Jackie Chan. Like,
Well, funny you should say that. This role was originally written for Jackie Chan.
I can totally see it. It felt like it could have been a Jackie Chan movie.
Yeah, totally. I mean, Michelle Yeoh is capable of doing everything Jackie Chan can, but
she
kicks butt. She is awesome. Also, yeah, her dad, played by James Hong.
Uh-huh.
James Hong has been in Hollywood for like 100 years. He has been in everything. He is awesome. He's one of those supporting actors, character actors, who's just there in everything and does a good job whenever he does it.
I mean, this movie really allowed all of the actors to stretch because they played different personas.
Mm-hmm.
And I really liked that a lot. Like how much range they all had.
Yeah.
Incredible range. And her dad's a fun character too.
See, it makes me kind of, I mean, you had told me last night about all the reasons why I didn't want to watch the movie, and now I kind of want to watch the movie again. We'll have to talk about it again. So, you also finished a book, you said. You read a book.
I finished, yes, I read A Month in the Country by J.L. Carr.
That took a long time. I'm just kidding. Sorry.
Which is actually a very short novella, and it's my second time reading it. This time the Close Reads podcast was doing it as their summer book, and I haven't listened to any of the podcasts yet, but I read the book. And I got even more out of it the second time through reading it. It's a story about a World War I veteran in the years immediately after the war. And he's back in England, and he's very damaged. He's shell-shocked. He has a tic, like his face twitches, and his wife has left him, and he's trying to like find his way in the world, and he's lost. And he's an art restorer, specifically a restorer of medieval frescoes in churches, which is a very, very, very
specific
yeah. niche job. So he arrives in this small town in Yorkshire, and he's been hired to uncover a mural that they believe is on the wall that was covered up. And some lady has left it money in her will for the specific purpose of having this fresco uncovered. And the pastor of the church really does not want to have anything to do with it, but there's money tied up that he can't get the money, his bequest, until her other bequests have like been fulfilled.
Okay.
So the protagonist is sort of there under this begrudging.
Yeah.
But it's sort of this idyllic season. Like he arrives in the spring, he stays through the summer and the fall, and then leaves like as winter is coming. And it's this beautiful idyll where he starts to find a place in the village, like the making relationships with people, making connections with people, being accepted by people. He also falls in love with the pastor's wife, but doesn't act on it.
Okay.
In a moment that's very redemptive. And it's a very quiet little book. Like, there's not a lot of action. It's basically just him uncovering this painting, which happens to be The Last Judgment. So there's a lot of meditation on art, on faith. He is a man who has no faith. And it's interesting because at the very end, he's confronted by the pastor who, it seems like, is a man who does have faith and who is sort of in despair because he can't actually communicate his faith to any of his congregation. Like, people don't want an actual encounter with Jesus. They just want the church to be kind of a social thing.
Right.
And in the end, it's not clear how the protagonist is changed or if he is. Like, it almost seems like this is sort of a time in his life that's bracketed off, but we don't really get much information about what happens afterward. It's obviously told from the point of view of many years later, but he doesn't give us a lot of information about who he becomes. So it's just a slice of life.
So this was made into a movie.
It was made into a movie, and I'm kind of pondering whether or not I want to see it and whether they would ruin it.
Well, it stars Colin Firth and Kenneth Branagh.
You know, that does kind of push me over to wanting to see it a little bit.
I thought that might push you over the edge.
At the same time, there's also another former soldier who is there, who is conducting an archaeological excavation. He's supposed to be looking for a specific grave, also a bequest by the same lady who left the money to uncover the fresco. Except he's kind of undergoing, you know, doing a sleight of hand. He's taking the money, he's conducting a dig, but he thinks that there's an older church there. And so he's actually like digging to find the ruins of the church, and he already knows where the grave is. And he waits until the very last day, and then he's like, oh yeah, the grave's over here. And he uncovers it.
There's a also very interesting. There was apparently a play adaptation, not sure where, in London maybe, of this with Peter Dinklage in the lead role.
Really?
Peter Dinklage is the little person, the dwarf guy from Game of Thrones and some other things you've probably seen. I'm sorry, I probably used the wrong term. I'm not sure what the right term is, but little person, I suppose. And he plays in the lead role, so that would be interesting to see. It was a play, so you can't see it, but.
Oh, wow. That would have been really interesting. Actually, speaking of Peter Dinklage, it came to my attention this week that he performed in a recent movie of Cyrano de Bergerac as the lead character, Cyrano. And they play it like it was a role that was written with him in mind. Like, so he plays Cyrano, who in the play, Cyrano de Bergerac, is in love with a woman, yeah, who doesn't love him, and he thinks that he is unlovable because he has a gigantic nose.
Right.
In the Peter Dinklage version, he plays Cyrano not with a big nose, but with his own physical stature, his
being a little person,
being short,
yeah, having dwarfism, yeah,
and. From the reviews I've read, it sounds really amazing that, I mean, he is an amazing actor anyway, and that he brings to Cyrano a pathos and a universalism that's sort of there in the original play. But the original play is always sort of plays more for laughs, like Cyrano kind of laughs at himself. And I, from what I understand, the Dinklage character, his Cyrano, is a much more straightforwardly tragic character. And that it's really becomes a story about what it means to be loved for yourself. It's also evidently a musical, which...
Wow.
Wow.
That would sounds interesting.
So that's on my list of things to watch this week, and hopefully I'll get a chance to watch that because It looks really interesting.
Cool. So let's move to talk about this week's mass readings. The readings for this week were, if to recall, is Abraham bargaining for Sodom and Gomorrah with God. That's from Genesis 18. Then there is the letter to the Colossians, where you were buried with him in baptism, in which you were also raised. So speaking of baptism, and then the gospel is Jesus teaching the apostles the Our Father, and then talking to them about prayer.
Right.
So one of the things I wanted to mention just first off, one of the first things that struck me about this is in this first reading, Abraham bargains with God. You know, he starts with, say there's 50 people worth saving. Okay. And God says, yeah, I'll save. I would save the city. I wouldn't destroy the cities for that. Okay. So what about 45? I mean, would you destroy these two cities just for over five people? You know, so he's like bargaining him down. And then when we get to the end of it, it's, you know, if there's at least 10, for the sake of those 10, I will not destroy it. And that's where the reading ends. We don't get the payoff, the kicker, which is that evidently there's not even 10 good people left in those cities, because Sodom and Gomorrah get destroyed, which I think is an interesting choice. Why does the church end the reading there? Because it wants to tell us something about prayer, I think.
Right. Because paired with today's gospel, the focus is persistence in prayer. Jesus talks about not giving up in prayer.
Right.
And Abraham is clearly a model for that, because he persists. He doesn't, you know, just accept the terms. He pushes.
Right. I like the fact that it's like, a friend of mine has arrived to my house from a journey. I have nothing to offer him. So, you know, give me three loaves of bread. I'm asleep. I'm in bed. The door is locked. Go away. And he just like keeps banging on the door. No, I'm not going away to give you the bread. Like, I'm not sure how much of a friendship this is going to stay for the guy who keeps knocking on the door all night. But it interesting, like Abraham's dialogue with God is a kind of prayer, right?
Right.
That's what we're saying. But even as easy as Abraham's dialogue with God is, you know, that back and forth, I mean, there's a real easygoing nature in this. There's a real, like, even as Abraham says, you know, far be it from me to talk to my Lord in such a way, I'm nothing and you're everything. There's still a familiarity there. But even as close as that is, it's not as intimate as our relationship with God is through Christ, through our adoption in Christ.
Right. And yet, how often do we dare to take up the role of Abraham and really take seriously the task of asking God for what we want?
Well, especially on behalf of others, which is what Abraham's doing. He's not looking for anything for himself in this. That's a big thing in this. I mean, yes, we can ask God for things we want, too, just like, you know, in the gospel about the, you know, the asking for the, you know, the bread, you know, was it? We know how to give good gifts to our children. How much more will the Father in heaven give the Holy Spirit to those who ask him? Like, it's okay to ask for the things we need for ourselves, but even like Abraham's asking for others to be especially persistent in praying for others with God.
Right. Although his nephew Lot is in the city. So he's kind of praying in terms of like, save my family members.
I guess. Yeah. Although, I mean, if he knows the city's going to be destroyed, he'd get him out, which is what he does.
But does he know that God will get them out? I mean, but it's interesting. He doesn't ask God, spare Lot. It's
right.
Spare the city.
Right, right.
So there's a lot of interesting little wrinkles mm-hmm. there.
Now, Father Emmanuel was the celebrant at our mass today, the Nigerian priest at our parish, and he discussed the different types of prayer. There's listening prayer, where we're like reading the Bible.
Right. And I really liked the way he framed that. He talked about like prayer of listening, where we read and we hear what God has to say to us. We listen to God.
Right. And then there's the prayer of thanksgiving, where we're thanking God for the things we have. And the Eucharist is a prayer of thanksgiving. That's what Eucharist means. It means to give thanks. And so we're thanking God for what he's given us, or for just for our lives, or, you know, for the blessings of the world. Then there's petition, where we're asking God for the things we need.
Right. Father made the point of saying that petition is the one that most people pray. Yes. Like people who don't pray still will pray prayers of petition.
Oh God, let me pass this test.
Right. Like, especially in those moments of like life or death crises.
Prayer in the foxhole.
Right. We ask God to help us in our time of need.
Yeah.
And that's like that out of our poverty, out of our need, we recognize that God is the one who, mm-hmm. who can give us what we need.
And then the other type of asking prayer is the prayer of intercession, where we're asking for what other people need.
Right.
Which is not inherently better necessarily, because I think, as you mentioned, Father makes clear that when we're petitioning God, we're crying out for him.
Right.
That's what that petition is. It's not just, you know, the laundry list, the Christmas list, here, Santa, this is what I want for Christmas. But it's a true, authentic prayer when we're calling on him for the things we really need.
Right.
And then he tells a story. Are you going to tell the story?
I feel like I was unclear. We had two different interpretations of the ending of the story. So here we go. He talked about how there's a man, and this is clearly a Nigerian story.
Yes.
The man had a big anthill outside of his window.
You have to imagine, anthills in Africa are not like a small pile of sand in your patio. Anthills in Africa are often like 4, 5, and 6 feet tall.
Right. And he wanted God to move the anthill. So he prayed. And he didn't just pray like once. He prayed like a whole novena of prayers. And every day he would wake up and he would look out the window expecting that God would have moved the anthill. And every day it hasn't moved yet. And he gets to the last day, the final day of his novena, and it's still there. So what does it say when we ask God to do something? And he cited the scripture. Like God says, if you have faith the size of a mustard seed,
you can move mountains.
You can move mountains. So this guy was persistent in prayer. He prayed for 9 days. He believed that God could move the anthill. Why didn't God move the anthill?
So I remember Father saying, and this is the problem, we have different memories of what happened. Father saying that the man then said, well, I didn't think it was going to work anyway. It could also be Father's accent was playing havoc with my hearing. Well,
there were a lot of fans because RA Church doesn't have air conditioning.
Yeah.
And one of them was causing some like feedback in the microphone.
Right.
The sound system. So right. There were some like technical difficulties. But what I heard was that if he was certain that God was going to answer his prayer, there was a certain amount of presumption in it, and it wasn't a real prayer. It wasn't really asking. It was just sort of demanding of God. Like,
I'm willing to give you the benefit of the doubt and say that you heard it better than I did, but because I kind of like this idea that the way you heard it advances, which is it's not enough just to be certain of that God will answer my prayer in the way I want it. Because that makes it into magic.
Right, because we say, you know, I think that a lot of people say, well, I prayed, and I really prayed, and I really asked God for a long time, and my prayer was not answered. And I think that the heart of what Father's, the story was saying is, what do we do when we pray, and we pray, and we pray, and we pray, and we are talking to God. We believe that God can do something, and the answer is no. Was my faith not? And I think that a lot of people's assumption is, well, my faith wasn't great enough. I didn't have enough faith, and God didn't answer my prayer because I didn't have enough faith. And they feel like it's a personal failure, like I am not good enough. God has said no to me because I'm not good enough. I didn't have enough faith. And I don't think that's true. I don't think that God says no to our prayers because we are lacking in faith. Because that doesn't really fit with who God is and what he's telling us. But I think that that's a very easy assumption to make. But he says that when we get that feeling that God isn't listening, when we come to the end of our novena and the problem is still sitting there, now we are at the point where Jesus was on the cross, and our prayer becomes the prayer of Jesus on the cross. My God, why have you forsaken me? And the thing is that when we come to that point of, my God, why have we forsaken me? We feel abandoned by the God who has told us that he will never abandon us, by the God who says, I will always keep my promises. And how do we reconcile Jesus, who says, knock and the door will be open, seek and you will find, with that no? How do we reconcile Jesus telling us, I am faithful, I will always keep my answer, with, my God, why have you abandoned me? And the thing is, though, that God is with us. Jesus doesn't make promises lightly. He is faithful. But the answer isn't necessarily the way that we want. It's not the answer that we want. It's not what we hope. It's not what we expect. And so when we're asking for something, what Jesus tells us is the deepest sort of prayer is the prayer of, not my will, but yours be done. So Paul, for example, he says, asks for God to remove the thorn from his flesh. And Paul's prayer is not answered. God does not remove the thorn from his flesh. But God, Paul hears God say to him, my grace is sufficient. My power is made perfect in your weakness. So that the answer to our prayers when it's no is that God wants us to experience our weakness. He wants us to experience our emptiness and to cry out to him from our need, not from our certainty, but from our emptiness and our longing and our powerlessness. That's where we're closest to God. That's where we're closest to Jesus on the cross. And that's when Jesus is present with us. Like, we are not alone in that moment of feeling abandoned. Because if we continue to call to God, we don't give up, but we continue to call, then we can enter into that moment of the cross. We can draw close to God who is drawing close to us. He's giving us not the thing that we're asking for, but he's giving us his spirit dwelling in us, living in us, being with us. So that share of the Holy Spirit is really God's answer to our prayers, even when we feel like God has said no.
Right.
Like, he might say no to the question you're asking, but what is he giving you? Where is his spirit in your life? Like, there is God's spirit there. He hasn't abandoned you, even when he has said no to your request in the way that you expect him to answer it.
Right.
Which is, I mean, this is the hardest part of prayer, because we want God to answer our prayers in the way that we want them answered. But maybe that's not what we really need. And God knows what we need. Maybe what we think we need isn't what we really need.
Or what he needs for his will to be done in the world.
Right. Like,
I mean, how everyone who's ever dying, the prayer is not to die. But the fact is, we all die one at one point or another, and we're all not going to die, you know, at 100 years of age in our bed when we're ready for it. And I mean, that's just the fact. So, but the way we die is, like, just as an example, is part of the plan. It's part of the will. He has a will for the world, and we can pray for what we want, which is the cancer to go away, or, you know, that sort of thing. But if that's not part of his will, if that's not part of the thing that will bring to fruition his plan for the world, then it's not.
But the thing is, we can't see.
We
the
don't
plan.
Know. Right. We don't
we
know.
We don't know why. We don't know. I mean, the fact is that we might never know why. I mean, not in this life.
Why did God allow Borgia popes and, you know, the really bad popes? And why did God allow the church in North Africa to be destroyed over, you know, before the year 1000, essentially? You know, why does God allow all of these bad things despite the prayers? I'm sure there were many, many prayers. God, take away this bad pope, you know, back in the Middle Ages. But he didn't. Not right away. Eventually. the fact is the God answers prayers in the way that he needs to be answered. Doesn't mean our prayers are useless. It's the paradox. Our prayers are necessary, and yet at the same time, not. there's a kind of a paradox there, because God is sovereign and can do anything without needing us to do it first, but he wants us to ask him. He wants us to cry out to him in love and in need, just like a mother waits for her child to hold up his arms and say, "Mommy, you know, pick me up, take me." So,
I mean, it's hard. It feels like there's not really a satisfying.
Right. It feels like a pat answer. It can sound patronizing even. God didn't answer your prayer because, well, he didn't need to. You know, it's like, well, that doesn't feel very good when someone I love is dying. And
it doesn't.
No. And I would, which is why no one ever says it the way I just said it, frankly. I mean, it's not a comforting thing. But it nevertheless, I feel like it's true. I mean, it's something that I've been trying to struggle toward understanding, is why does God answer prayers the way he does, or not answer them the way we don't want him to? And the truth is because it's not part of his will, and it's hard to accept that, but it is the truth of things. Anyway, I'm not the Pope. Don't take my word for that as gospel. It's my part of my struggling to understand the will of God, and whether if that's useful to you, I commend it to you. If it's wrong or whatever, I'll gladly change it. So just I want to throw that out there. That's right. Speculation on my part, personal piety and devotion. All right, we should wrap things up. We want to take a moment to thank our patrons who make it possible for us to create Raising the Best, including Riley J., Richard S., Linda K., Jolie G., and Eric U. Their generous donations at sqpn.com/give make it possible for us to continue Raising the Bets and all the shows at StarQuest. You can join them by visiting sqpn.com/give. So that's it from us. We would love to hear from you. You can let us know what you think about anything we've talked about by visiting our Facebook page at facebook.com/StarQuestMedia. Send an email to bets@sqpn.com. That's BETTS. Or visit the StarQuest Discord community at sqpn.com/Discord. Remember to like Raising the Bets on the StarQuest Facebook page at facebook.com/StarQuestMedia. Retweet us on Twitter at SQPN and leave us comments wherever you find us. We love to interact with you. Until next time, I'm Don Bettinelli.
And I'm Melanie Bettinelli.
Thank you for listening to Raising the Bets on StarQuest. Here's another show on the StarQuest Network you're sure to enjoy, The Secrets of Star Trek. Find it wherever fine podcasts are found or at sqpn.com/StarTrek.